My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead, and I'm happy to introduce Dan Spencer, professor of environmental studies at University of Montana. And this is his fourth session this week, one more tomorrow. And so tomorrow's session is at 11, so which has been Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And today's topic is I have to look deep time for climate change, faith, and ethics, living on, with, and light the earth. Dan.
Thank you so much, Sharon. Anybody else in the room here grew up Catholic? They always like to say, when you're Catholic, guilt is the gift that keeps on giving. Lutherans do well with that as well. But I feel a little guilty just because the weather has been so beautiful this week. You know, I keep pulling people indoors, but I think you should all be out there experiencing the climate directly. But I really appreciate folks being here. This is the fourth of a series that I'm calling Deep Time. The first two sessions, we viewed a documentary and talked about the history of our universe as it's being revealed to scientists, cosmologists, as about a 13.7 billion year history. The Earth's history is about one third of that, about 4.5 billion years. We looked at some of that there. And then I'm looking at three different issues that are contemporary issues that I think are connected to this notion of deep time. To get some sense about what we mean by deep time, a couple hundred years ago, the consensus in the Western world was that the Earth was about 6,000 years old, and that was the best academic scientific consensus we had. With the emergence of geology, and also more recently with astrophysics, we've lengthened that from 6,000 years to 13.5 billion years, which is a huge expansion. So we're trying to still grappling with what it means to think about being in that kind of time scale. So yesterday I did a talk on the geological history of the Pacific Northwest, just to give ourselves a sense about what it means to be living in this particular corner of the planet, but the history that's brought places like Holden and the North Cascades to us. Today I'm going to move to a more contemporary issue, which is the whole issue of climate change, but I want to locate climate change as part of deep time, because since the very formation of the Earth has had weather systems. And it's had, since relatively early on, an atmosphere. That atmosphere has changed drastically over geologic time. And climate change has constantly changed, but climate change is intimately related to life on the Earth there. For example, the only reason that we have oxygen in our atmosphere is because of the emergence of forms of life that exclude oxygen. Prior to that, and it's one of these real ironies of life here, that the earliest forms of life, oxygen was poison, it was toxic. There. And so as the Earth faced this real paradox that as it generated more and more forms of life that kept exuding oxygen, oxygen began to build up in the atmosphere, which was poisonous to the life on there. And so as we talked about last time, and I'll talk about especially tomorrow, life always has three options when the environment changes. If it can, you can move. So for example, we're seeing a lot of our species of plants now, as we get warmer and warmer climates, are moving north where the climate's cooler. Or you can die. If you don't adapt at all, you simply die out. And over 99% of all forms of life that have lived are now extinct. So we have a long history of extinction. Or preferably you can adapt. You can figure out how to adapt there, and life is rooted in all sorts of kind of genius adaptations. And so life not only adapted to oxygen being in the atmosphere, many forms of life now require it, ourselves included. So I just bring that up here to simply say that climate change is nothing new under the sun. It's really, it's as old as the planet itself here. What I want to talk about today, though, is the kind of climate change that we're experiencing currently. Is Sharon still here? I'm going to lower, if we could lower these lights at least here, I think we'll see better there. They're right behind you there on the wall. And take those in. Folks still see me okay? And I just want to make sure you can see this here. So it's the rapidity and the origins of climate change today that are so distinctive that I want to talk about. Now I want to start with this photograph that Pat and I were able to go to a panel of a lot of climate change experts and scientists a few weeks ago. And one of my colleagues at the University of Montana, Steve Running, started with his talk here. So I'm just shamelessly stealing this from him. Anybody recognize where this is?
Yes.
In fact, you can see this is the Lake Chelan Valley, right? This is Lake Chelan going right up here. We're probably sitting somewhere right in this area here, Puget Sound, Seattle, Tacoma, that whole area there. But what Steve wanted us to notice here is, see that little tiny thin blue outline on the planet?
Yep.
That's our atmosphere. And it's about 10 miles thick. And relative to the rest of the earth, it is a tiny, tiny, tiny amount in terms of volume and also in terms of what it actually contains there. And what Steve was reminding us here is that our atmosphere is both resilient and fragile. We sort of think about it as a huge amount of stuff up there that we can keep dumping things into, but that's actually wrong. And our atmosphere is what really regulates the form of life on the planet here. So I want to put it, I framed it here as a precious but fragile atmosphere there that really makes a difference on everything else that's living going on the planet there. So we'll come back and look at that as we go along here. What I wanted to talk about, I think there's going to be some sobering news in the presentation I'm doing today because climate change is a really significant challenge for us. But I also think there's some really good news. And I want somebody to start with what I consider to be some of the good news. And that is almost all of the religious traditions in the world are starting to take climate change seriously. And they are engaging with it and they're producing studies and topics there. Those don't always get down to the level of the pew, the local congregation. That's our big challenge. How can we take the teachings of our traditions right now and really begin to think about them here? But I was asked is Abby here? I don't know if Abby Hugh Seth is here this afternoon. I hope she's out hiking. But she is part of a really important group in Missoula, my hometown, on faith and climate change, or faith and climate action. They put together this panel and asked me to speak about religious perspectives on that. And so the Interfaith Power and Light, which is a fantastic interfaith organization that looks at energy issues in particular, but also issues around climate change, put this together just that there are many different emerging views and perspectives on climate change here. But we have a long way to go. If you were at both Hal Taussig's and Barb Rossing's talks this morning, it came up that, ironically, white Protestants are the group that least believes in climate change of all the groups surveyed. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life a couple years ago did an extensive survey on religious communities here. And this is, I just wanted to spend a little bit of time here. You can see, moving from left to right, this question, is there solid evidence that the Earth is warming? Yes, and it's because of human activity. Yes, but it's because of natural patterns. Yes, but I don't know the cause, or no. Now, I would say the good news is that nearly half of the U.S. population agrees that it is happening, and it's happening due to human activity. And that's my position as well, and I'll talk to you about why that is. Another 18% of the U.S. population says it's happening, but says it's just simply part of the natural patterns. And that's certainly understandable, because I mentioned before, climate change has always changed naturally on the planet there. So there's although I think the science is disproving that here. And roughly 1 in 5 in the public simply says it's not happening on that area here. But interestingly enough, the group that is most persuaded that climate change is real and it's human caused are people who are not religious, who are unaffiliated with religious traditions there. They, for whatever reasons, being religious or being part of a faith community correlates more with not believing or denying that it's happening here. We'll break some of this down a little bit here. The white mainline Protestants are about pretty similar to the U.S. population. So if you, most of the folks who come to Holden sort of broadly fit into the white mainline Protestants group, although some of the others in that there. White non-Hispanic Catholics, pretty significant there. Black Protestants, about 40%. But the group, the white evangelical Protestants, is the group only about 1 in 3 view climate change as real and human cause on that. And so there's a sort of a breakdown as we start to think about where faith communities line up on this here. This is a really interesting comparison because on the left, this is the public versus scientific perceptions of what's happening in climate change here. And I'll unpack it a little bit here, because I think we have a pretty big gulf between what scientists, and particularly scientists who work on climate change, are saying, and the overall public. So again, roughly 50% of the US public here says it's happening because of human activity. All member scientists of the American Academy of Associated Science there, it's about 87, a little under 97% here, say it's happening, it's because of human activity. But it's even more dramatic when you start looking at scientists who work specifically on climate change. And so these are three different studies of scientists who are publishing on climate change. And it's a little bit hard to sort of see some of these here. This color, and I'm really bad with color, so I'm just going to point to this color, which I think, what does that correspond to this one? So 98% of most frequently published climatologists, these are for whom climate is their specialty, see that the human contribution to climate change is significant. And only 1% say humans have little or none on that. And these are various different categories. These are scientists who publish on climate change. These are specifically climatologists. These are general earth science faculty. So you get some different range across there. Of course, these different studies here. But by and large, with the exception of one study here that had a 2008 study that was looking at member scientists in this area, it's less than 5% who don't see human beings having a significant impact here. So this is a big challenge for us because all the best science is pointing to global climate warming or climate change is real and it's primarily human cause. This is an interesting graph here too. Also says it's one thing to acknowledge it's real, it's another thing about whether or not I should be worried about it. And so again, this was a November 2014, a couple years ago, 2.5 years ago, polling different folks here. Interesting, so all Americans, about 29% are very concerned, and another 21% somewhat concerned. So roughly 50% of the population is very or somewhat concerned. Interesting enough, look at the breakdown here. Hispanic Catholics are by far the largest group to be either very concerned or somewhat concerned. And the folks who followed up on this noted that oftentimes these are folks who are poor, they are more vulnerable to the effects of climate change, sometimes they're farmers or that, but we see a real correlation between poverty levels and vulnerability to the effects of climate change. And so I don't think it's coincidental that you have Hispanic Catholics and Black Protestants as the two largest groups of religious folks who are most concerned about it, because they're already in many places directly experiencing this here. In contrast, it's the white population in the country that's most resistant. At the bottom, white Catholics and white evangelical Protestants pretty closely there, and white mainline Protestants a little bit more above that there. So we see this a really interesting, and we know how this also begins to break out politically in terms of our political system, in terms of which religious groups tend to support which folks on that. Please, come through. So this is just a snapshot to give us a sense about the current panorama in our country about attitudes or views towards climate change here. Now, I put this slide in here. Just again, it's a little bit of a confusing slide. It's the one that Pat and I saw again just a few weeks ago here. But this is a report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the United Nations panel that's been working for several decades now on climate change issues. They got the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 for their work on this here. Because one of the things you'll oftentimes hear from people is that they accept that climate change is real, but they see it as happening from natural causes here. And certainly there are natural causes that contribute to climate change. So that is very true. But what this graph does is shows the overall percentage of things that are either causing the planet to warm, and those are the red bars, or to cool, and those are the blue bars there. And I just draw your attention here. This is the amount that is due to a change in energy from the sun, which is what sometimes is there. So you can see it's almost non-existent. All of the other effects here, and this is climate change activity since 1750, which is sort of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Almost all the other effects, carbon dioxide is still by far the largest, CO2, which we get from burning fossil fuels especially. Methane is a much, much more potent greenhouse gas. There's less of it, but when you release methane, it's much more damaging in the short term. And then there's quite a few other ones. Nitrous oxide is a big one that comes from car exhaust, that part of the area here. Now you'll notice there are some things that actually contribute to cooling here. One of the ironies is when we were still using a lot of aerosols. Aerosols are really damaging to the ozone layer, that's why we got rid of them. But ironically, when you put particles in the air like that can reflect sunlight back, it can actually have a cooling effect. It's one of the reasons when we have major volcanic eruptions, we oftentimes will have a cooling effect for the next year or two. So like Mount Pinatubo a few years ago in the Philippines happened on that here. But the overall notion is that we have somewhere with about 2.5 degrees of warming in the 1750 coming from human caused sources there. So this is the science that I'm drawing on when I talk about the issues around climate change today. So what I want to do, though, is start with some of the good news, because I think it's really good news that a lot of the religious traditions are beginning to use their own sources within their tradition to begin to respond to this here. So I want to just take a quick scan of some religious statements and some scan of religious responses to get us located in that here. There are very diverse views within the United States. As I mentioned before, when former President Obama came out with his climate plan there was a whole group of black clergy, from the black churches, who came out in support of it and said this is really important for our faith traditions, as did on the right there you see Hispanics were leading U.S. Catholics on climate change. The two religious groups who have been most responsive to seeing climate change as real and having a negative impact on their communities. Don't worry about this so much, but if you're interested, this is simply a listing of all the different groups that have issued religious statements on climate change there. So you can see Baha'i, Buddhist, and then in a Christian here, you've got everything from Baptist, Catholic, Church of the Brethren, the Episcopalians, all the way through. Almost every major denomination now has had a study group on this and has made a statement on it. The Lutherans are no exception on that. Barb talked about some of that this morning here. You see a couple different ones from the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America here. But some of the most important statements, I think, come from some of the older traditions. These are our indigenous communities. So almost 10 years ago, in 2009, several different indigenous groups or Native American groups got together, came up with what they called the Mystic Lake Declaration there. And again, you're going to see there's a lot of text on these slides, so I'm just going to read some highlighting things here. But they said, indigenous peoples must call for the most stringent and binding emission reduction targets. We call for national and global actions to stabilize carbon dioxide concentrations below 350 parts per million and limiting temper increases to below 1.5 degrees Celsius or centigrade. Now that's more ambitious than even our international treaties are talking, which are trying to limit it to 2 degrees Celsius there. The 350 parts per million has been sort of the scientific consensus. If we go much above that for sustained time, then we will exceed the acceptable limits there. Anybody know where we are currently in terms of parts per million CO2?
Well, we're
over 400 now, somewhere about 407 on that. We passed 400 a few years ago. So we're well above the 350 parts per million, and we continue to climb on that. So people have talked about we not only need to stabilize where we're at, we're going to have to begin to reverse some of this if we want to keep within those limits there. But the indigenous peoples have been at the forefront of trying to make this happen. My friend Barb Rossing, if you've been to some of her talks, has brought up several times the Pope's leadership on this. I think the Pope is probably the single most important person at a global level right now in terms of taking leadership on climate change here. He, a couple years ago, came out with this document called Laudato Si, or On Care for Our Common Home, where he says, I just have one quote here, in the face of the emergencies of human-induced climate change, social exclusion, and extreme poverty, we join together to declare that human-induced climate change is a scientific reality, and its decisive mitigation is a moral and religious imperative for humanity. There's many reasons I'm so impressed with what Pope Francis has done in this key here, but part of it is reflecting his very name. You may know that popes in the Catholic Church take on a name from the Catholic tradition when they become pope. And the sad thing for me is that Pope Francis of Assisi has been around for 700 or 800 years. No pope prior to him thought that that was the name to take for him. But this pope, who comes from Argentina, he's the first Latin American pope. He's been many years immersed in the lives of the poor in Latin America. He explicitly chose the name Francis because Francis cared for both the poor and the earth. And Francis linked those two. And you see it in his statement here. In the face of the emergencies of climate-induced climate change, social exclusion, and extreme poverty. So Francis links these as a moral emergency of our time, particularly because of what is happening to the planet and what's happening to the poor and them. But there have been others who extend a lot of leadership here. Bartholomew, the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew of the Orthodox tradition, you know there are three great branches of Christianity. We have the Roman Catholic tradition, we're familiar with the Protestant tradition, but the Eastern churches are the Orthodox churches there in Russia, in Greece, and so forth on that. And Bartholomew, for over well over a decade, has been calling people together. 10 years ago, he issued, together with the Greek Orthodox Bishops of America on Global Climate Change, a Moral and Spiritual Challenge there. And I just read through a little bit of this here. In order to make the required changes, we're called to pray first and foremost for a change in our personal attitudes and habits, in spite of any accompanying inconvenience. Such is the depth of metanoia or repentance. So the Bartholomew is really linking this to a call to repent from our actions there, the implication that our actions are sinful in causing this. The issue is not merely our response to climate change, but our failure to obey God. We must live in a manner that is consistent with what we believe and how we pray. Nevertheless, we cannot stop there. We must raise the issue before public officials and elected representatives at the city, state, and national levels. And he's been at the forefront of this here. One of the things that the patriarch Bartholomew has done is every year he gets world leaders together and he takes them out onto the Black Sea, which borders where he is. And then they look at a particular set of environmental issues. It might be water one year, it might be climate issues another year. But he keeps trying to link faith with our response to our public responses on that. Worldwide Anglican Communion, the Anglican, very close to the Catholic tradition, also close to the Lutheran tradition here. They had a call to urgent action for climate change a couple years ago on Good Friday, a worldwide call to this here. And I lift this up here because they are lifting up what we have come to call environmental justice, the linking of environmental and social justice issues on this. And so this was a Good Friday call. At this time of unprecedented climate crisis, we call all our brothers and sisters in the Anglican community to join us in prayer and in pastoral, priest, and prophetic action. We call with humility, but with urgent determination, enlivened by our faith in God, who is creator and redeemer, and by the pain of our people's experience in our dioceses and provinces, and their need for seeds of hopes. In different ways, each of our own dioceses are deeply impacted by climate injustice and environmental degradation. And I think this is such a really important linking coming out of the biblical traditions that always link environmental and social injustice there. This whole term of people are calling climate injustice calls our attention. We'll talk a little bit more about what we mean by that here. Climate justice is attention to the disproportionate impact of climate change, particularly on indigenous peoples, women, the poor, and young people. It has a disproportionate negative impact, and these are some of the most vulnerable people on the planet. So the call is, this is a call for social justice as well as environmental concern on that. I'll go through just a few more of these quickly here. The Buddhists have gotten together a couple years ago in May 2015 and have come up with, they have a what they call the Green Sangha. Sangha is the Buddhist community. So they're trying to do an environmentally oriented Green Sangha on this that is consistent with Buddhist values. So you see the ecological consequences of our own collective karma. They lifted up on that notion here. They're calling to decarbonize our energy systems on this. Judaism has been at the forefront. There are several really important letters that have come out of the Jewish tradition on this. This was a rabbinic letter on the climate crisis that came out a couple years ago. And again, you'll see this linking. The unity of justice and earth healing top our ancient texts and experience. The worsening inequality of wealth, income, and political power has two direct impacts on the climate crisis. On the one hand, great carbon corporations not only make their enormous profits from wounding the earth, and parenthetically, many of the wealthiest corporations in the world are our climate, what they call it carbon corporations, call our fossil fuel corporations. But then they use these profits to purchase elections and to fund fake science to prevent the public from acting to heal the wounds. Notice the use of fake science here 2 years ago. This didn't come around just in the elections here. They were all calling our attention to here. On the other hand, the poor in America and around the globe are the first and the worst to suffer from the typhoons, floods, droughts, and diseases brought on climate crisis. So they go on then to call for a new sense of eco-social justice. They have, the Jewish tradition has this wonderful tradition of tikkun olam, which is our duty to repair the earth. And they link that now with tikkun tevel, the healing of our planet, to call for a Jewish ecological response on that. Really, and I'm not going to go through this. This is just some of the ways they talk about specifically how to do it. You know, purchasing windborne energy, divesting, putting their funds, divesting from carbon funds and putting in there. a whole series of actual recommendations on this. I was really encouraged to find this because the world of Islam has been quieter on climate change, but that's beginning to change. And so a couple years ago in Istanbul, they had an international Islamic climate change symposium to come together to take a look at the Muslim tradition on climate change here. And again, what each of these traditions are doing is using their own theological tradition, their own insight, to figure out how to get their communities to begin to respond to that. So you'll see the Arabic terms of corruption for facade in this here. And I love this one down here. We recognize that we are but a minuscule part of the divine order, yet within that order we are exceptionally powerful beings, and we have the responsibility to establish good and avert evil in every way we can. Right? We recognize that we are but one of the multitude of living beings with whom we share the earth. This is such a powerful statement because we're the only species that's directly causing climate change, but we share the planet with at least 30 million other species of life. And they're being forced to live, adapt, or die in response to our actions here. So they lift us up and say, we have no right to oppress the rest of creation or to cause it harm. And so it's, again, a Muslim tradition on this response on this. They did declare a whole call to action. I'm not going to, again, go through it all here. Just wanted you to know what's going on. But they particularly call on the well-off nations in the oil-producing states, which is where a lot of Islam is located, to have particular responses. And notice in here, we need to provide, those of us in Afro nations need to provide generous financial and technical support to the less well-off so that they are not left behind on these issues here. We have to recognize a moral obligation to reduce consumption so the poor may benefit from what's left. So we see this going on in many, many different things. The Dalai Lama has been very, very vocal on this. She seeks for climate justice here. Hinduism, I could go on and on. I just want to give you a sampling, and I see this as a real sign of hope. I think there's a big awakening going on in our religious faith traditions around the world, but the challenge now is to get that from statements into the pew, into our congregations where people are studying this and learning about what their own traditions say on this here. My own community, outside my faith community, is oftentimes the slowest response. I participate in the academic community, but even the academics are starting to pick this up here. And I wish Barb, you're not, is Barb Rossi here? Barb, I wish Barb were here, because Barb called my attention a lot of this here. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, the American Academy of Religion did its whole focus on climate change. And I always say this brings together 10 or 12,000 of the nerdiest people on the planet that you can imagine, scholars of religion, put us all together in these big convention halls. But the president of the American Academy of Religion, Lori Zola, did her whole presidential address called Interrupting Your Life and Ethics for the Coming Storm, reference to climate change. Bill McKibben, who's an active Methodist layperson, has started an organization called 350.org. The 350 comes from that 350 parts per million, which we need to see as a cap for our climate. He gave a plenary address there. It was really exciting to see even academics doing this. And even our evangelical Christian sisters and brothers are starting to do this here. Catherine Hayhoe, if you ever get a chance, she has some fantastic talks on YouTube. She's been very, very active. Her husband is an evangelical pastor in Texas. She's a climate scientist at Texas A&M University. They have written a book together on a climate for change, really specifically addressing the evangelical community. We're beginning to see this in several different aspects there, particularly among young evangelicals, who tend to be more attuned to the environment, I think, than older folks on that. But I'm very excited about that here. And this is just, we see all sorts of resources going on for local change here. Faith and Climate Action, did you see Climate Smart Manu Zula? Abby Huseth, who is in the village right now, is one of the main organizers in that. But lots of things going on. So that I take as some really good news. What I want to do, though, is to, if you remember, the title of this talk is Learning to Live On and With and Like the Earth. Okay? My contention is part of the problem, or a lot of the problem of how we got into the problem of climate change is we haven't done that. We've lived as if the earth is kind of a passive stage for our human drama, and we haven't worried about the consequences for the earth. I'm going to argue we need to learn how the earth itself has maintained life for 3.8 billion years sustainably and learn to live like that there. So this is where I'm going to come back to deep history and deep time and go back into my geological background here. So quick question for the, anybody recognize where this is? And I'll give you a hint, it's not in this country. And I'm going to give my friend Barb a hard time for not being here, because I put this slide here. Lauren, we've got to give her a hard time.
No problem.
Do you recognize where this is? Lauren, you've been here.
I can't. Yeah,
Barb should be really excited to see this picture.
One of the coolest places in the world.
On the planet.
Yes.
This is the Burgess Shale. All right, the Burgess Shale, which I'm not going to spend time on that, which I could if you got me going on geology. That'd be much more fun in some ways. But what I want to draw your attention to is the rocks that go from... So Burgess Shale is in Yoho National Park in Canada. So these are the Canadian Rockies. Here. It's the border of British Columbia and Alberta in the Canadian National Parks there. The Burgess Shale is like on every geologist's bucket list, because these are some of the earliest soft-bodied fossils that we know of in the world. They're over 500 million years old, and they just record this explosion of the diversity of life 500 million years ago. And you can only get there, you have to have a special permit and can hike with the ranger and stuff like that. But I was able to go there last summer. It was a really exciting thing for me. But the reason I put this picture in here is any folks who recognize what kind of rocks are in the background here, from here all the way to the top of that mountain. And I'll give you a clue. Yeah, I'll give you a clue. It's the same kind of rock type found on Mount Everest. Limestone. This is limestone. So what is limestone?
Fossilized.
It's fossilized what? Seashells, right? It's fossilized all the different forms of life in the oceans that take carbon and create their soils, and they turn carbon dioxide into calcium carbonate. And I'll go through that a little bit, CaCO3, if you do your chemistry on there. Where does that carbon come from? It comes from the atmosphere. So what happens when you create limestone is all these life forms in the ocean, the oceans are our biggest storage of carbon dioxide. They take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, it goes and dissolves into the ocean, and all those life forms take and build their shells out of it. And then when they die, their shells fall down, and eventually they build up. This is tens of miles of thick of limestone here. What you're looking at here is fossilized atmosphere. Fossilized atmosphere. It's really, really interesting to start thinking about this here. That took hundreds of millions of years to get. So why is that important? What does our atmosphere do for us? Particularly, what does carbon dioxide in our atmosphere do for us? Yep. But what else? It does a really important thing. If we didn't have carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, what would our planet be like?
It moderates our climate.
It moderates our temperatures. That is, you've probably heard of the greenhouse effect, right? The greenhouse effect is simply when the solar radiation comes in, it comes through the clouds here, it bounces out the earth, and some bounces back out and stays there because of carbon dioxide, which keeps our planet warm. If we didn't have good carbon dioxide on our planet, we'd be like the planet Mars, way too cold for life. But if we had too much carbon dioxide, we could become like the planet Venus, where the surface temperature is about 800 degrees, because there's a really thick one there. So Earth has had this atmosphere with just the right amount of carbon dioxide in it to keep the temperatures moderate for life to live there here. And why I'm going to talk about this geological thing here is scientists have found... For a long time, we thought it was just the Earth was just lucky that we were not too far and not too close to the sun. We just happened to be in the right spot to have the right temperatures for life, which is true. But folks who study stars have come up with a really interesting discovery, and that is stars go through a life cycle as well. And in the 4.5 billion years since the Earth has been around, the sun has increased its radiation by 25 to 30%. Over the history of the Earth, which means we should be much hotter today if nothing had changed, right? We're getting almost 30% more radiation from the sun here. So why didn't the Earth simply get baked? Well, here's where this incredible genius of the Earth, or God, whoever's involved in this, made this happen here. As this Earth kept heating up, it kept drawing more and more carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So it made the carbon blanket thinner, so it was warming us less and less. Where did it put it? Put it in all these ocean rocks. So we have it also put it other places I'll talk about here in a moment here. But the Earth has basically self-regulated itself to keep the temperatures on the surface conducive to life for 3.8 billion years. It's just kind of an amazing thing to start thinking about how the Earth has done this here, while the sun is getting hotter and hotter on that here. It does it through something called the carbon cycle. I won't bore you too much on this here, but as I mentioned before, the surface of the Earth is constantly changing, and in many ways it's a living thing. We have plate tectonics that are moving the surface around. We have the atmosphere, we have water, so forth. So there's all sorts of different cycles that go on. We have an oxygen cycle, a water cycle. A really important one is the carbon cycle. A lot of carbon is found in the atmosphere, and you probably know that when we exhale, we're exhaling carbon dioxide. Plants inhale it. Plants need carbon dioxide, so they absorb a lot of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It goes into their forms of life. They produce energy that gets passed on to animals like human beings or cattle or deer or grizzly bears. And we keep that in there. A certain amount enters into the soil, into the ground, passes through this area here, and then this here, we're going to talk about this, is the other sink here, oil and gas. We're taking carbon out and storing it and burning it, and it goes back into the atmosphere. Historically, this has been a fairly well-balanced cycle. So about the same amount that came out of the atmosphere went back into the atmosphere. And as Barb mentioned earlier this morning, a couple hundred years ago, we were at about 280 parts per million of carbon, which doesn't sound like very much. You got 280 carbon dioxide molecules for a million ones in there. But it's a very sensitive kind of temperature gauge on that. We've now, because of the Industrial Revolution, we have really ramped up this part of the cycle here. So we're up over 400 parts per million on this. Now, some of you were here in my geology talk yesterday. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here, but geology historically has been the big regulator of this, what they call here the long-term scale of both carbon and oxygen. So remember, I mentioned that the longest mountain ranges in the world are these submarine, these underwater mountain changes here. When they erupt lava, they also have a lot of CO2. So a lot of carbon comes out through volcanic eruptions, both under the ocean and on land here. The fossils are forming on the oceans underwater here, on these things here. Some of that gets buried down below there, so they're taking the carbon back down. Some of it gets pushed up on land to make those big cliffs, limestone cliffs. So the long-term cycles have been really significant for the amount of carbon dioxide we have in here. But it's the short-term cycles that we have to really focus on now here. And so, again, there's too much information in these charts, and I'm going too quickly, stop me. I'm happy to spend a little bit more time on here. But what I want you to give you a sense about is this is what are called carbon sinks, are different forms of the planet that absorb carbon. And then it will exchange it, the carbon exchanges have it come back out there. So you'll notice that one of our big sources of carbon in the atmosphere today is deforestation, particularly the cutting of the tropical forests there. And this is one of the reasons, it's a whole other lecture, but a lot of people are increasingly tying climate change concerns to our food systems. Because a lot of the reason why we're losing our tropical forests is they're being converted over to pasture land to raise cattle to support meat-based diets. So we've got these really different kind of links. I'm going to look at more of that next week here. But so deforestation is a significant source here. This is just terrestrial production. You're both drawing it down in the forest and putting it back up in that area there. Here's some of the industrial stuff that's going on, exchange with oceans here. But what I want to give you a sense of here is that, look at the numbers. I don't remember exactly the numbers that show up there, the atmosphere. I remember exactly the measurement on these here. But terrestrial ecosystems, that is land-based ecosystems, somewhere around 2,200 is the total amount that's going back and forth in the carbon. Deforestation is fairly small in that, too, all right, in those different things here. You can start to see fossil production 6.5. Seems like pretty small numbers, but they're making a big difference there. Notice the number for the ocean. Surface of the ocean, 1,020. The deep ocean, 38,000. The ocean is absorbing the vast majority of carbon that ends up in the atmosphere. About 93% ends up in the oceans. We'll come back and talk about it. That's been a really good thing for us in the short term. If all of that carbon had stayed in the atmosphere, the planet would be much hotter right now. The ocean's been absorbing a lot of it, which has had a cooling effect to keep us down there. It has some other problematic long-term effects there. But two numbers I want to draw your attention to here. Carbonate rocks, those are those big mountains with that, 65 times 10 to the 8th. That's a really, really, really big number. So what it means is the vast majority of all the carbon that's been produced historically is now being stored safely in these carbonate rocks. Now, interestingly enough, one of the big sources of carbon dioxide we have today is from cement, making cement. Anybody know why that is? What do we do with cement? You mine limestone and grind it all up. When you grind that all up, you're releasing the carbon. So we don't even think about cement, but cement is a big source of here. Nonetheless, carbonate rocks have done an enormous service to the earth. Most is locked up there. And it's locked up relatively permanently. We're not going to mine all those mountains there. But the other place it's locked up, and this is much more volatile, is fossil fuel reserves. And this one here, and this is where I wanted to credit Barb, because Barb is the first one who taught me about this here. Thinking from a divine perspective on this here, that we're really fortunate that, did you notice the number of fossil fuels is 4,000? Much, much bigger than we're producing industrial scale, much bigger than that. But what happens if we take these fossil fuel reserves, which have been safely sequestered underground for over 100 million years, and now we put them in the atmosphere? We're basically reversing what the Earth has been doing for hundreds of million years to keep the atmosphere stable. Right? Part of the reason if all of this carbon had never been put underground in oil and natural gas, it would be in the atmosphere, it would be much, much warmer. And so we've had this process here. Barb likes to talk about it in terms of God's activity of sequestering these fossil fuels as a way of maintaining conditions for life on the planet. The problem is right now is we're doing our best to tap these fossil fuel reserves and take them directly from underground and put them in the atmosphere. And that's what's driving a lot of our climate change there, is our kind of our voracious appetite. Now, don't get me wrong. Tapping the fossil fuels has made our modern world possible. We've had an enormous number of benefits from it. The obvious ones we think about are things like transportation. But all of our plastics are based on petroleum-based things. And all the modern miracles of science, of medicine and so forth, we've created a whole world that's pretty dependent on it. The problem is we're now paying the price with what it's doing in the atmosphere. So as I mentioned before, these examples, all of these mountains here are limestone. These are those big, big sinks that have pulled, these are fossilized atmosphere that pulled that carbon out and kept the planet from overheating on that. The other one that I mentioned is the fossil fuels. And fossil fuels, the way that fossil fuels break down is that they're ancient vegetative matter, plants and animals primarily. Particularly, there was a period in the Earth. It's actually called the Carboniferous period because it had so much explosion of life there. All that life gets buried and it turns into things like coal and natural gas and oil. And again, the effect of bringing this out of the surface and burying it there allowed the planet to stay cooler. It helped the planet to sort of self-regulate on that. Our challenge now is we're pulling it out again. And as I mentioned before, the one we don't think about as much here is the ocean. The ocean is in constant contact with the atmosphere, and it's constantly drawing calcium back down into the atmosphere, or your carbon into the water here, absorbs a lot of it here. The challenge with this is that, and here's again just a minor chemistry lesson here, when that carbon dioxide gets dissolved into the water, it attaches to calcium carbonate, which is a good thing. That's what makes up shells and so forth. But it also forms a weak acid. And so the oceans are becoming more and more acidic as this carbon is going, it's getting overloaded in there here. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more. So these are the big sinks. The ocean has been a big benefit because it has absorbed a lot of this dissolved carbon dioxide there. Other parts have gone into the coal and gas and those things. Others have gone into the actual rock itself on that. Okay, so the big problem right now is in the last 200 years, we've emerged as the agent on the planet that's reversing this cycle. We are reversing the Earth's carbon sequestration and taking all that safely sequestered carbon and putting it up in the atmosphere, because we think of the atmosphere as kind of an infinite dumping ground. If you go back to that really early picture I showed you of the 10-mile thick atmosphere, it's a very, very thin layer, but it's like the cell of a membrane. All of life depends on it from there. And so what we've been doing is overburdening these sinks, okay? And so you can see this is the upper layers, is the amount of carbon that's increasing in the atmosphere, the amount that's been increasing in the ocean, and then you'll notice the land one has fluctuates all up and down there. It depends a lot on the local weather years in terms of what kind of growth zone that. But the overall trend is to keep increasing there. The problem is carbon sinks are like sponges. At a certain point, they can't absorb anymore. And when they can't absorb anymore, then it stays in the atmosphere, and the atmosphere begins to increase there. And so what we're seeing now is global warming, right? The actual warming of the planet itself on that here. And so this is the tipping point happens. It's really interesting. You see that from about 1940 to 1980, it was kind of fluctuating a little bit. The trends were much cooler. We've been at Holden a little over 100 years ago, 120 years ago. It was called the Little Ice Age. There were much more glaciers in the mountains, stuff like that. But the trend has definitely been upward on this time. This period, really, since the mid-70s, 1980, is when it really has launched upward there. I teach another class with my students at the university on the global economy. And this is kind of when globalization also took off. We really ramped up our production and ramped our international transportation going on there. Nonetheless, what we're seeing is this a steady upward trend that's been going on for the last 100 years and heating the planet on that. What are some of the results of this? One of them is as we warm the planet, the ice caps in Greenland are beginning to melt. The glaciers are melting, and so we're seeing rising sea levels here. Sea levels rising for at least two reasons on that. One is we're adding more water to the oceans. As you melt the ice caps in that, we're just simply putting more water that has to go there. But the other thing that people don't notice much here, what happens to a liquid in terms of its volume when you warm it? It expands. So we're warming the oceans, and they're also expanding that way as well there. So we're beginning to see fairly dramatic, these are different places, Los Angeles, San Francisco, these are US places here. We're beginning to see dramatic things. And on a day-to-day level, it's not so noticeable. But what happens is whenever you have a storm surge, like if you're in Miami or if you're in New York, like Hurricane Sandy, when you have a weather event, what can be a very, very small little amount of 1 or 2 inches there, when you begin to concentrate that and move it inland, then we see these really, really damaging results. So sea level rise around the planet is starting to go up at a fairly fast rate. Part of what's problematic about that is about 70 to 80% of the world's population lives within 30 or 40 miles of the ocean. This is where our densest areas, our major cities are. And so we're burning that as well. This is the other one I mentioned before that was relatively hidden. I mentioned we've had a big benefit, the fact that the oceans have absorbed so much of this carbon dioxide, but it's coming at a price of the ocean there. As you add more and more carbon dioxide, it reacts with some of the materials in there to form carbonic acid. And that carbonic acid then, there's Barbara, I've been quoting you right, love, Barbara.
I'm sorry, I've been getting my hair cut.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I gave you lots of credit, so
good.
I'm glad you're here. But you missed the picture of the Burgess Shale, so I have to go back to that.
Okay.
But anyway, as you increase this acid there, the limestones and things begin to break down. And so the life forms here, this just shows what happens after 0 days, 15 days, 30 days, and after 45 days, the shells of these creatures are no longer able to maintain themselves because they're now increasingly acidic. And so the acidifying of the ocean is having a really dramatic impact on life there. We're seeing this all particularly in coral reefs. This is something that's absolutely stunning to me. I don't know if any of you have followed what has happened to the Great Barrier Reef off Australia this year, but roughly two-thirds of it died this year. This is the largest coral reef system in the world. And coral reefs are the incubators for all of marine life. Marine life depends on healthy coral reefs. So it's too soon to know whether some of it will come back or not, but there's like 450 to 500 mile stretches that they just died this last year, and it's a combination of the warming and the acidifying of the ocean. This is happening worldwide. There's a real concern that within 20 or 30 years we could lose all of our coral reefs on there, and with that goes a lot of the ocean biodiversity. So the ocean acidification is a big challenge on that here. So this raises the question then, and there's other problems we can go into, but that's enough of the bad news. I hope I've convinced you this is fairly serious stuff here. So what do we do about it? Well, increasingly, there's a group of people who are looking seriously at technological solutions about saying, well, if the problem is having too much carbon in the atmosphere, why don't we take the carbon out of the atmosphere? And so we'll see geological sequestration. They're looking at different ways of capturing the carbon and storing it, injecting it underground and storing it back down there. We don't have the really good technology here, but that's one whole area that people are beginning to think about how to, in some ways, reversing what we've done. We've been drilling for the oil and releasing that carbon into the atmosphere. Now we're trying to figure out how can we capture that and put it back down on the rocks and keep it there. Some promising things on this here, but some problematic ones. Some of the most intensive work is being done, and I think some of it's a little frightening. And this is the notion of geoengineering. It's based on a very simple principle. I mentioned before, when we have volcanic eruptions, we oftentimes see climate cooling globally for the next year or two. Why would that be? Why would a big volcanic eruption cause the climate to cool? Yeah, I think I'm hearing stuff and all that good mumbling, but when you put particles in the air, those particles actually reflect some of the sunlight back. Interesting enough, so does smog. You know, so this has been one of the trade-offs. We cleaned up places like Los Angeles, where I grew up, where it used to be so much smoggier. And that's really good for people who live there. But ironically, that smog, we see it like in China, that actually has some cooling effect because of those particles. But what scientists are thinking about is if we could actually inject particles into the atmosphere, we could lower the temperature of the planet on that. That's the theory on that. And there's actually testing and stuff going on to try to do some of that. There's several problems with this, however. Anybody ever heard of the law of unintended consequences? We see this all the time here. And so I actually like this slide myself here.
If you go back, let me just say this right,
and I'll go back in just a moment here. So I think I really like this slide here. It just says, got a climate problem? Try stratospheric sulfite aerosols for that quick climate fix. Warning, side effects may include water cycle alteration, drought, ozone loss, upper atmospheric warming, ecosystem alterations, and delays to greenhouse gas emission reduction negotiations. Please consult a lawyer before speaking. I'll come back and talk about this, but let me go back in here, Barb. Yeah.
Why are you including biochar as geoengineering? That's an ancient, low-tech practice that was done by the South American people. That one is very safe.
It's a geoengineering. I mean, it's using different kinds of geoengineering, and some of these are different. Some of these could really work. I mean, afforestation, planting more and more forests could be a really good way to do some of this here, where you're trying to absorb it on there. So there's different things on this here, but it's the proposal that attended me here, and I've got another slide I'll get to in a moment here. This is just the range of different things, and I'm simply saying there's a whole range of technological solutions that people are trying to do. The problem is most of the attention is going to not things like biochar, not things like afforestation, but are really looking at this kind of thing here, the increased reflectivity from low clouds by spraying in them, and increased reflectivity from putting aerosols pumped into the atmosphere. And so this is where Barb was talking before about Bill Gates is investing quite a bit in this. There's quite a bit of activity around this here. The real challenge, I mean, there's a lot of challenge on this, is that we simply don't know what the different responses would be. There's two particularly big problems here. While the effects will be global, the effects will be local. Right? There's different modeling showing, for example, depending on how much, first of all, who gets to decide whether we do this or not? And if you do a certain level, it could be really good for North America, but it would set off droughts in India and China. That is, weather patterns are really, really variable around the planet there, so there will definitely be winners and losers in this. And who gets to decide, who gets to vote on that as well? The other thing that's really problematic is once you start this, you're committed to doing it in perpetuity. Because this is seen as a fix. Notice we're not talking about reducing carbon emissions. Carbon emissions are going to continue to go up because we can keep protecting our industrial way of life. But now you've guaranteed that you have to keep injecting things in the atmosphere. If you don't, then all that new carbon in there will rapidly heat the planet. So it launches us onto a trajectory which is really problematic in terms of future generations. We're committing them to a lifestyle that we're enjoying now that's inherently unstable in that. And so it raises this question then, how do we respond? And I want to just talk a little bit about what we responded nationally, and then we'll get to the point of opening up for some discussion here. The key one, about 25 years ago, was what's called the Kyoto Protocol, where several different nations got together. Al Gore helped negotiate this he was vice president of the United States at that point there, and negotiated a process of trying to reduce climate emissions there. For a lot of reasons, probably that this was a really problematic accord. The United States ultimately refused to sign on to it, so we didn't have the world. The United States at that point was by far the world's largest emitter of carbon dioxide. Didn't on there. It didn't have caps from any of the poorest nations. People, so India and China, which were rapidly industrializing, and people saw that as a problem for not having the caps. But the biggest problem is even when they began to implement it here, if you look at this graph here, so from 1990 here, 1992 is when the accord is signed. By 97, it's going to affect. The climate emissions just have to continue to rise. It simply didn't work. And so here's a notion here. It says, since 1990, the world's CO2 emissions have increased by a shocking 51%. So this was the first global effort there. And yet, if anything, climate emissions actually accelerated since the signing of the Kyoto Accords. So it became really clear internationally we're going to have to take a different path on that. And that there's been a kind of a twofold path. President Obama's, I think, was the first administration to really take climate change seriously in terms of U.S. participation on this, worked hard in coming up with a U.S. Clean Power Plan to really try to begin to lower U.S. emissions in transforming, moving away from fossil fuel sectors in our power generation. These are things that you used to find on the EPA website. They've all been taken down with the new Trump administration here. But the United States began a really aggressive plan to begin to lower and limit it. Interestingly enough, the United States actually has decreased its emissions in the last few years here, or stabilized them in some places, decreased about 5% less. That's predominantly because we moved away from coal towards natural gas. But you've heard of the rise of fracking, and fracking has increased the amount of natural gas, which burns more cleanly than coal does. So we've actually had some positive results on that in that area there. The second thing was a renewed international effort, and this culminated a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago. And I see Abby is up there in that area. My friend and colleague Abby Husseth is a graduate of our graduate program, actually attended the Paris Climate Change Accords in the United Nations. Got 193 nations, that's 187 at that point, but 193 nations to sign on. Every nation came up with a voluntary plan about what they would do to begin to decrease greenhouse gas emissions and make other changes. It was just kind of an enormous achievement in that here. And so we had a lot of momentum coming out of that here. At least in the United States, that momentum seems to have stalled at the moment, at least in the levels of government right now. President Trump campaigned on a campaign calling climate change a hoax, and within 2 months of being in office there, in March 2017, he issued an executive order to reverse the Clean Power Plan, so he pulled the United States out of its Clean Power Plan there. And then just less than 3 weeks ago, he announced his intent to have the United States withdraw from the Paris Accords in there. So what's really happening is very interesting happening. I should have actually added some things in here. This has actually mobilized intense activity at local and regional other levels there. So there's a whole campaign going on right now across the world called We're Still In. We're Still In the Climate Accords. There are over 1,000 mayors in the United States have signed on to this. Our local mayor in Missoula has signed on. I think Seattle's has signed on. Lots and lots. And so but what seems to be happening is rather than stopping this progress, it's shifting the attention right now to local, state, and regional governments, which we'll see whether that comes out on that here. But that's sort of where we're at right now, and I want to have some time for discussion, but this is one of my favorite cartoons. You may be familiar with it here. You can see the list. This is taking climate change will lead to energy independence, preserve the rainforest, sustainability, green jobs, livable cities, renewables, clean water, air, healthy children, et cetera, et cetera. These are at least the promises there. And this one here, this one of the audience says, what if it's a big hoax and we create a better world just for nothing? All right, let's maybe have the lights up go up here, and let's just open up. We got some time for discussion. I throw a lot of stuff at you, but if just to recap here, there are both hopeful and problematic signs of where we are. Some of the hopeful signs, I think, for the faith communities are beginning to come around to climate change, take it seriously, begin to mobilize it out of here. We have a, I'm going to talk tomorrow about what a very promising avenue that I consider here called biomimicry. Talk a little bit about that here in the origin. But my overall goal is I think we can look to the way the Earth has maintained itself for billions of years, the conditions of life from there. We can examine our own behaviors and say, to what extent are we following that model, or are we pioneering a different model on that? And I hope we can begin to moderate our own behaviors to move back to that kind of sustainable, resilient model. But let's see what people want to talk about. Yes, back here.
Scott Pruitt, when he was announcing the U.S. withdrawing from Paris,
yes.
Dr. James Hansen has his authority that Jim Hansen called it a fraud, Paris. But the reason Jim Hansen called it a fraud is because we didn't put a price on carbon.
And we didn't go far enough.
Right.
Yeah, that's a really good point. James Hansen, foremost climate scientist in NASA, really began talking about this in the 1980s, trying to draw our attention to that here. And yeah, Paris, I would say, I would call it Paris to recycling. Okay, you hear a lot of times people trying to get people to think about the environmental issues, and people say, well, I recycle. And the point is, recycling should be our first step to moving into greater environmental stewardship. The problem is, for too many people, it becomes the last step. And so recycling is a great way to start bringing attention to things, paying attention there, but it needs to be the first step into changing our overall lifestyle. The Paris Accords, I say, is kind of a similar thing. Even when people signed them, they knew they were not sufficient to get the kind of reversing that we had. Nonetheless, it was a really important first step. You've got 193 nations agreeing to work together on this. And until you take that first step, you can't take the second and third steps. So yeah, Jim Hansen is entirely correct, you know, that it's not sufficient. And so if we pretend it's going, the Paris Accords are going to solve our problems, then it's a fraud. But you notice it's picked up by somebody who has no intent of there's Scott Pruitt. Again, I don't want to make this into a political dry time at all, but I'm very concerned that Scott Pruitt is the named the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, former Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, sued the APA many, many times, does not believe in these kinds of things here. In fact, I sometimes have said he's now the head of the Environmental Predation Agency. Because it's, you know, the President Trump has named to the heads not only there, but almost every cabinet position, people who are fundamentally opposed to the mission of those cabinet level offices there. But Scott Pruitt, for me, is one of the most concerning ones here because he's very smart, very astute, and he works very closely with the energy corporations, and I think can reverse a lot of our stuff here. Yeah?
Another hopeful sign on the political front, even, is the creation of the Climate Solutions Caucus in the House of Representatives. Now, people can join it, one Republican and one Democrat at a time, and it's really seeking a bipartisan or really a nonpartisan solution to climate change. There are now 44 members. There were six pairs, so 12 members in November. There are 44 now. I understand there are three more pairs or six more people, so there will be 50 people, members of the House of Representatives, joining the Climate Solutions Caucus, and they have named a subgroup to develop a political, a legislative solution. Both Republicans and Democrats are talking about a carbon fee and dividend approach, which puts a price on carbon, but it provides a 100% rebate to everyone in the U.S., right, equally. So
it's a revenue neutral approach, but it taxes carbon.
Turns out beneficial or covers the cost or better than covers the cost for about 60% of the households. The model, economic modeling shows. But I think so that's a possible solution, and George Shultz and Jim Baker presented it to the Trump administration here.
This is what's so important, because I think, frankly, one of the biggest political tragedies of the last 20 years is that climate change and global warming, which 20 years ago was a bipartisan issue.
Yeah.
I mean, as recently as the 2008 elections, John McCain, the Republican candidate, actually had a more progressive, more aggressive climate change plan than Obama did.
Right.
His candidate. John McCain was very active in this, and there were other Republicans. Somehow it became a partisan issue. And so now it's almost a litmus test in the Republican Party that you have to oppose climate change in order to be elected to office on there. And unfortunately, there have been several Republican candidates who tried to take climate change seriously. They were targeted by big oil, they were defeated. And so there are a lot of Republicans who recognize exactly what's going on, but it's too politically costly for them at this point. So we've got to find a way to change that political climate on that.
I was just going to add that the first two members to start that are both from Florida.
Is that right?
And
yeah.
What sea rise is flooding your streets.
They see what's going on.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing is and support those, you know, support and help your congressman become a member of the Climate Solutions Caucus.
It's really important because every state has different kinds of local effects. For example, in Montana, we don't have to worry about sea level rise. We're far enough inland and high enough that that's not going to affect us directly. But our fire season starts much earlier, goes much longer, and our fires burn hotter and much more intense. And there's real concern that the forests in Montana, the next time when they burn, will not regenerate this forest. They're going to be moving towards grassland, shrubland. And so people talk about in Montana, within about 30, 40 years, our climate will be much more like Salt Lake City. We're going to be much more like the Great Basin moving there. What will be like in Montana will be up by Banff and Edmonton, you know, like that. But every area, and so we do have to find ways to get our politicians on board on this here. Actually, Abby, do you want to just mention your visit to, because you went to Washington, D.C., with Faith in Climate Action, and you met with our senators and our representatives. Well, I don't think we had a representative yet, but our senators. You want to just mention a word about that?
It's an interesting experience.
Because our state senator is actually a Lutheran. I mean, our U.S. senator, well, Republican.
Yeah, we have one Democrat and one Republican, and we met with them both. And our Republican representative is not a total fundamentalist. He's willing to at least entertain the idea and at least agree with us that climate change is real. But we didn't seem to want to move on the idea of really changing anything about our energy production. And we often get, Montana is a big coal producing state, so there's definitely challenges there, and the coal lobby is pretty powerful. So that's a challenge for sure. It was a bit of a frustrating experience, and even our Democratic senator, because of the electorate in Montana, has to really toe a pretty hard line as a moderate Democrat in order to kind of get over the hurdle, and he's coming up on re-election next year. So it's a really complicated issue, but even the farmers unions and stuff are really starting to come out and say, hey, this is a real problem. But yet again, you see the disconnect between people who understand that climate change is a problem and then tracing it back to actual human activity and what those human activities are. So I'm hopeful that that's the first step of saying, okay, you're right, we do have a problem, but how would we do it?
I'm going to call him Barbie in just a moment here to give the example you were telling us a little bit about the church in Minnesota, because part of what we have, we're in this real dilemma right now, I think, and this is one of the things I really experienced as an educator. We have to educate more and more about these issues, but the language itself has become so polarized politically, so partisan. We may have to find ways of addressing the issues without even calling it necessarily climate change. We may have to find other ways there. We had a really revealing poll in Montana. They went out and surveyed all the farmers in eastern Montana, and over 85% of them recognize that climate change is happening. They're not done. They've been farming all their lives, and then they know spring comes earlier, the summers are hotter, and like that. But when they map their responses on a political scale, the more conservative, the more conservative they became, the less they believe that it was being caused by humans. And so by the time you got over to conservative folks there, only about 20% of the conservatives, they all acknowledge climate change is happening. But the response was it was a natural event and we can't do anything about that. And that just maps right across the political spectrum there. But what we're finding sometimes is if you don't call it climate change, if you talk about, well, how do we protect our forests? How do we protect our soil? How do we think about preparing for drought? How do we become less dependent on fossil fuels? These other things. There's all sorts of ways to operate jointly together there, but we may have to find ways to do it that don't actually name what's happening. And that's a real problem from me perspective, because you've got to educate about it, but it's so toxic right now. But Barb, do you want to just mention a little bit what you were talking about, the Church of Minnesota?
Yeah, this was the Garden of Minnesota, Nisswa, I forget the name of the church, Church of the Cross or something.
Lutheran Church of the Cross.
Okay. So, okay, and they had me up there to help with their solar panel dedication.
So I preached at two services. We had an all-day energy fair on Saturday that also had all kinds of environmental stuff. And they've got a garden right there. I mean, they're very active on energy stewardship and everything environmental, but they just said don't use the word climate change. But if you go to 100% renewable energy, one of the most active people on renewables and solar panels is a Tea Party person nationwide. So they convinced me, you cannot say climate change, but we'll do everything to move towards a totally transition to renewables. Just don't use that language. So yeah, it was interesting.
So I'm apologize to cut this off because there's another group coming in at 4:00 and I don't want to be late on them. But I wanted two things. We are having a faculty forum tonight here, and several of us on the forum panel are going to talk further about responses to climate change. So if that's interesting to you, feel free to come to that.
Yeah, we can have that be the primary topic.
And then tomorrow, if this is interesting for you, I'm going to talk about how many of you know the field of biomimicry? This is one of the most fascinating things out there. I'm going to talk about how we learn from the earth as field of biomimicry and talk particularly about the promising things on climate change that are happening on the field of biomimicry. So I don't want to leave of it in despair. We're going to have a really hopeful, positive session tomorrow morning. If this is of interest to you, come back for that. But I really appreciate the conversation and the input, and we'll just keep talking and copy-paste. So thanks very much.